Exodus 6:10 through 8:19. The ninth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on May 26, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to begin talking about the plagues in Exodus. When God decides to finally move and force Pharaoh to let the Israelites go, he does bring in the big guns. He inflicts 10 plagues on Egypt of varying degree of severity, the last one being clearly the most severe. But there were 9 plagues that preceded that. And the section in Exodus that talks about those plagues is a fairly extensive section of the narrative. So it obviously plays kind of a central role, pivotal role in the story of the Exodus. Today I'm going to talk about the first 3 of those 10 plagues. They seem to come in sets of 3. And we'll talk about the pattern more in a couple of weeks, but there seems to be they come in these sets of 3 where there's the first plague is accompanied with certain things, the second plague is accompanied with certain things, and the third plague comes unannounced. And we'll talk about those particulars later on. But the reason I'm doing the first 3 is they seem to come in sets of 3. At some point in time, I would like to talk about the plagues as a whole. But I decided to do that after I've worked through the plagues so that I have something to say, hopefully. And the other thing that I would like to talk about sometime is miracles in general. What is the nature of these miracles? And are they supernatural? Are they natural? Are they some of one, some of the other? And does it make any difference? But I thought I'd wait on that till I have something to say too. So we will start where we left off last time. In chapter 6, I talked about the first 9 verses. So we begin with verse 10. Just briefly, what's happening in the first 9 verses is after Moses had appeared before the Pharaoh the first time, asked him permission for the Israelites to leave, Pharaoh said no and made life more difficult for the Israelites. So the foremen of the Israelites, who were Israelites, went to the Pharaoh and asked for him to ease up on them. And Pharaoh said, no way. And so when these foremen came out from their meeting with the Pharaoh, Moses and Aaron were standing there, and the foreman said, may God judge you, to Moses and Aaron, blaming this on Moses and Aaron. So Moses then turned to God and said, this isn't working out. I came here to release them from slavery, and instead of being able to release them from slavery, things have just gotten worse. So God, please do something. And then God's response was, I'm going to. And I'm going to do it now. Not only will Pharaoh let the Israelites go, he will force them to leave. And then he said, up to now, I have been known to the patriarchs as one who makes promises. But now you're going to see a different side of me, and that is one who comes through on his promises. one who carries out his promises in dramatic fashion. So that was his response to Moses, and he indicated that Moses was to take that message to the Israelites. And verse 9 is a wonderful verse. So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage. The pain was too great. Their focus on their situation was so fixed that they couldn't hear this message that God was about to move. Verse 10 then. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the sons of Israel go out of his land." But Moses spoke before the Lord, saying, "Behold, the sons of Israel have not listened to me. How then will Pharaoh listen to me if I am unskilled in speech?" Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron and gave them a charge to the sons of Israel and to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Now I will mercifully skip the genealogy and pick up again verse 28. The genealogy lists the ancestors of Moses and Aaron. Verse 28 then. Now it came about on the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, that the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "I am the Lord. Speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I speak to you." But Moses said before the Lord, "Behold, I am unskilled in speech. How then will Pharaoh listen to me?" Now, Moses is bringing up something that he had brought up earlier, remember, back when God appeared to him in the burning bush. One of his concerns, he listed several concerns, and one of them was he was unskilled in speech. And God's response was, "I will give you Aaron to speak for you." But the context there seems to have been that the Israelites would not listen to him. And in fact, the Israelites have not been very responsive. Initially, the Israelites responded well. They acknowledged that he was from God. But then when things got tougher, they said, "Well, on second thought, maybe you aren't." So they have not responded real well. And now his concern is, if they have not responded well to me, if they have not accepted the authority that you, God, gave to me, then how can I expect Pharaoh to think that I have any authority from you? So his concern is slightly different here. It's his authority with respect to someone else that's his concern here. God responds to that in chapter 7, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh, that he let the sons of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst." So Moses and Aaron did it as the Lord commanded them. Thus they did. And Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. God's response to Moses and his concern about his being unskilled in speech is similar to the response he had given when God was in the burning bush. But it's a little bit different. He says, "See, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet." When he spoke to Moses in the burning bush, he said, this is chapter 4, verse 16, "Moreover, he," that is Aaron, "shall speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as a God to him." So previously, when Moses was concerned about addressing the people of Israel, that they wouldn't accept his authority because he didn't speak well, God said, "I will put another person in here. I'm going to put Aaron in here. He speaks well. You will be as a God to him, and he will speak your words. In that context, he said, just prior to that verse, he said, is there not your brother Aaron, the Levite? So apparently what God is setting up in chapter 4 is a priesthood. He's indicating the role that Aaron will play. Moses will be as a God to Aaron. He will speak to Aaron, and then Aaron will speak to the people. And I think what's happening here is Moses is describing, or God is, in history, is building in this picture of what a priest is. In chapter 7, it's a different picture. And here he's referring to him as a prophet. He says, I will make you, that is Moses, as God to Pharaoh, and your brother shall be your prophet. So apparently then, this other picture he's painting is of a prophet, one who takes the words from God and speaks them to someone like Pharaoh. Now, I'm not sure all of what that implies. I'm pretty confident that what we have here is a picture. In fact, I'm becoming more convinced that what we have in Exodus, and to a certain extent in Genesis, is a pictorial dictionary of theological concepts. That God's using history as a vehicle to create in human history these pictures of theological concepts that he uses later in other books and even into the New Testament. And one of those pictures is, what is a priest? And he seems to be saying that a priest is one who takes the words of God and relays them to the people. And I assume what that means is to those of belief, to those who are responsive to God, would be my guess. Here we have Moses speaking the words to Aaron, who relays them to the Pharaoh, and he refers to him as a prophet. And I'm wondering if the distinction is not here he's speaking to someone of disbelief, someone who does not believe, and they are words of judgment and condemnation. I'm not sure that is all that he's doing here. I'm not sure that's all that it means to be a prophet. I'm not sure that's all that it means. In fact, I'm quite certain it isn't all that it means to be a prophet or all that it means to be a priest. But he is creating these kind of building blocks, these kinds of visual aids to help us to understand some theological concepts that are used later on. So, God is assuring him then his concern will be taken care of with respect to his speaking to Pharaoh. Pharaoh will receive his words. Now, in chapter 7, God's response shifts from the impact of his signs and wonders on the people of Israel to now it's the impact on the people of Egypt. It's the Egyptians who will see God's power. Verse 4, when Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt. I will bring out my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel, and the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. Remember, the first response of Pharaoh when Moses went to him was, I don't know him. I don't know that God. And God's determined that they will know him when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. Okay, so now God's ready to move. He has given Moses his marching orders, and he's going to move with intensity at this point. Moses, by the way, is 80 years old. So it's at 80, the age of 80, which is considered to be an old age at that time. And Aaron, by the way, is 83, so Aaron is his older brother. Aaron must have been 3 years old when the decree was given that all male children of the Hebrews would be put to death. Okay, verse 8, we see the first plague then. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Work a miracle,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent.'" So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did, just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same with their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned it into serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. So the first thing that Moses and Aaron are supposed to do is they come before Pharaoh, and when Pharaoh says, "Work a miracle," which reminds me of a line from Jesus Christ Superstar, from one of the songs, I can't remember who, it's Herod, who's singing it? I can't remember who's singing it, but it's the one where he says, "Jesus, walk across my swimming pool." But it's this mentality, show me your stuff, what can you do? Work me a miracle. How much power do you have is the question. How much power do you have? Why should I listen to you? Why should I fear you? How much power do you have? So what Moses and Aaron are supposed to do is throw the staff down and it turns into a serpent. I would think that would be that'd be quite a feat. I would think that that would gain some attention. To take the staff, throw it down on the ground, and it turns into a serpent. But Pharaoh asked for his magicians, his priests, to come in. And they are all apparently able to replicate this same feat. They take their staffs and throw them down, and they turn into serpents. The commentaries note that this is a trick that is common in northeastern Africa, that there is some kind of serpent that if you pinch it behind at the base of the neck, that it becomes stiff and will remain stiff until it is shocked with something. So you can make the snake, the serpent, stiff, and by throwing it down, the shock brings it out and it starts moving around and stuff. I'm fairly credible. Gullible is probably the best word. I suppose it's true. I don't know if it's true or not. But that's what they point to as something that is done that they could be referring to here. I don't know if that's what they're referring to or not, but I suspect from the biblical account that we're talking about two things that on the surface look similar, but in fact, one is a much more profound kind of miracle or sign. And I suspect that for two reasons. One is talking about the magicians using their secret arts. There's no indication that Aaron uses any secret arts. Aaron takes the staff and puts it down and it turns into a serpent. The magicians, however, do it using their secret arts. The other is the last verse where it says, "But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs." And I think that's pointing to the fact that there was something more profound, that what Aaron did was a truer sign and less of a trick than what the magicians did. That what the magicians did was a cheap imitation of what Aaron performed. But Pharaoh looks at the two and he says, "Yeah, that my magicians did the same thing. Yeah, it's pretty much the same. So our gods are a rival to Yahweh. I have nothing to fear." His concern is not truth. His concern is, who has the most power? Where am I vulnerable? Okay, Pharaoh was not impressed. His heart was hardened. He did not listen to them. So then comes the first plague, verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water, and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile, and you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. And you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you have not listened until now. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. And the fish there in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, over their streams, and over their pools, and over all their reservoirs of water, that they may become blood, and there shall be blood throughout the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. So the first plague was to turn the water of the Nile into blood. Now, the Nile was crucial to the life in Egypt. Egypt didn't have any rainfall to speak of. In order for them to raise crops, they depended upon the water from the Nile, which they drained off into canals and would water their lands. They also depended on flooding that occurred. It was very regular for the most part. It came at the same time every year, lasted about the same amount of time, and every year it brought down fresh, fertile soil from the mountains to the south. So they didn't have to worry about fertilizing their land. They didn't have to worry about exhausting their land. It was renewed every year by this flooding that occurred. So this flooding was very important to the Egyptians. It's something that's pointed out as a significant point of contrast between Egypt, which was one of the most ancient areas of civilization in the world, and Mesopotamia, which was one of the other most ancient areas of civilization in the world. In Mesopotamia, the floods were very violent and unpredictable. In Egypt, however, they came almost at the very same time every year, and they were always relatively tame. They knew about how high they would rise, and they were very predictable. As a result, Egypt became a place that it was a very conservative culture. Things ought to stay the same all the time. You want to maintain stability, keep things the same. In Mesopotamia, you have constant upheaval and change, different worshiping different gods, different nations rising to ascendancy. Egypt, it's one group of people for the most part that are in power for almost the entire period of the ancient world. And culture stays very rigid, very, very conservative, static. They worshiped the Nile as a result. The Nile was so important to them, it was a god. And this flooding that occurred, it did turn red. The river would turn red every year. So apparently the plague here is that this year it would be redder. There's something more distinctive about it. Maybe it's redder. Maybe it's a bigger flood. It's not clear. But there must be something else along with it, and that is bacteria or something. Something that causes the fish to die, because typically the fish did not die during the flooding time. And in this case, they do. So there was something that was different about this. Now it says that the magicians could do, let's see, have I read that yet? Let me read the next few verses, starting in verse 20. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded, and he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile, in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. And the fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. And the blood was through all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. And 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. Now the magicians, they could do this too. But my suspicion is what it's talking about is the magicians were able to perform this same feat. That is, the magicians were able to say, the water of the Nile will turn red. But I suspect what they were doing was predicting. That they could predict when the floods would begin. And so Pharaoh looks at what Moses is doing and he's saying, well, my guys can do that. I mean, this is no big deal. My guys can turn the Nile blood red. But in fact, this is a different event in that the fish are dying and it is not drinkable. Something that was not normally true. As a result, Pharaoh just turns away and says, no big deal. No big deal. My magicians can do that. So that's the first plague. It lasts 7 days. The second plague is apparently a consequence, something that naturally follows from the first plague. Verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. And the Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed and into the houses of your servants and on your people and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. So the frogs will come up on you and your people and all your servants. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the streams, and over the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. And the magicians did the same with their secret arts, making frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So here's the second one. It's the frogs. Apparently, they cannot stand the water. That with the fish dying in the water, not only is it not drinkable, but it's no longer a habitat where the frogs can live. And so they're coming out of the water. Now, apparently, that the frogs coming out of the water is not out of the ordinary. When the flood occurs in Egypt, the frogs come out about that time, and I can't remember why. I think they laid eggs in small pools and stuff or something. But they come out of the water onto the dry land. So that's not atypical. What's atypical is the vast numbers that are coming out. And the fact that they're going into places where they didn't normally go. So here it says that the magicians did the same with their secret arts. I suspect this means that typically the magician able to bring about the same phenomenon where the frogs leave the land. I'm not sure. But it's hard for me to imagine how they would duplicate this thing when the frogs have come out of the water and they're all over the land and now the magicians do the same thing. I don't know what exactly that would look like. My suspicion is that it's saying the magicians typically did this same thing. They were able to perform the same feat. Now, the frog was also worshipped as a god in Egypt. The frog was the god of fertility. So God seems to be picking on the Egyptian gods one by one, turning the Egyptian gods, having the Egyptian gods appear to be acting contrary to the interests of the Egyptians. seem to be cursing the Egyptians themselves. This plague, even though initially Pharaoh was not impressed with this one either, apparently. Once the frogs are everywhere, this bothers Pharaoh, as we see in verse 8. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Entreat the Lord that he remove the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go, that they may sacrifice to the Lord." And Moses said to Pharaoh, "The honor is yours to tell me, when shall I entreat for you and your servants and your people that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses, that they may be left only in the Nile?" Then he said, "Tomorrow." So he said, "May it be according to your word, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. And the frogs will depart from you and your homes and your servants and your people, and they will be left only in the Nile." Now this is a little different. This is interesting because this is something that up to now it's been a matter of prediction. At least it could be. The Egyptian magicians have been able to, they can cause the river to turn red. But if my understanding is correct, they're just predicting when it turns red. They can predict when the frogs will come out. But if I'm correct in my understanding, it's just prediction. When will the frogs come out? Now he turns to Pharaoh and he says, "Tell me when you want the frogs to die." This would be different because it's not predictive, but rather it's bringing it about. And that's something the magicians haven't been able to do, is to actually bring about something happening. That Pharaoh could tell them the day when he wants the river to turn red or the frogs to come out. It's like the difference between being able to predict when there'll be an eclipse and going to the Pharaoh and say, "When would you like an eclipse?" That's a very different thing. Pharaoh's not patient. He says, "Tomorrow. I want those frogs out of here." Verse 12, "Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, the courts, and the fields. So they piled them in heaps, and the land became foul." It must have been incredible. If they smell anything like mice, dead mice, it must have been pretty rank. Okay, so it happens as Moses had asked. The frogs are no longer coming out of the river. They're just dying in place, and they pile them up. It is curious that the Egyptians seem to be preoccupied with cleanliness. This must have been a real difficult thing for them to cope with. Verse 15. I love verse 15 because it's so true. "But when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not listen to them, as the Lord had said." When there's a crisis on, he calls in Moses and Aaron, and he says, "You got to get rid of these frogs." They say, "Well, okay, whenever you want to. When would you like it done?" "Tomorrow! Immediately, I want it done." So he's desperate. When the frogs are all over the place, he's absolutely desperate. The frogs are dead, and he says, "No big deal. No big deal." He's got this... I've been talking about this way that we as human beings have of looking at the world. And it is so focused on the present. And here Pharaoh is exhibiting that same problem of being so focused on the immediate present. When the crisis is on, he senses his desperation. He senses the fact that Yahweh really does have power and is willing to let them go. But as soon as the crisis is over, it's no big deal. April Fools. I didn't mean my promise. It's like the foxhole conversions. I mean, it just is so typical, and it's so typical of me too. In times when when things are really critical, things are really bad, and I cry out to God, and there's and relief comes from that particular incident. And I would have to say that there are a number of times that that's happened. And I mean, it happens many times a year when things seem pretty critical, and I'll pray to God. And sometimes he responds soon, and sometimes he responds much later than I want him to. But there are times when I can really see a connection between reaching a point of crisis and God doing something that brings about a change in the situation that I had not foreseen. But it doesn't take me too long before I look back at it and say, no big deal. I mean, it could have happened anyway. I remember, was it last summer you went back to Colorado? Last summer, Susan abandoned me for a few hours, for a few days with the kids. I was working for Jeff Chase at the time, helping harvest beets, driving a tractor. And she was going to be gone for 5 days, right in the middle of the beet harvest. And I was going to take care of the kids. And Neek went with her. So I had the three youngest that I was to take care of. And my mother had graciously offered to help me out, but inflicting all three of those energy-laden youngsters on my mother for 4 or 5 days seemed to me unconscionable. And I did rather agonize over it. Now I prayed over it considerably, and as it turned out, it either rained or it got too hot or something happened, and the cannery sets the schedule. But just before she left, it looked like I was going to be working all 5 days, or at least three of those days for certain, and probably 5 days. And was it after you left that they called and said, I don't remember the details, but I didn't work any of those 5 days. And I look at that and I think, on the one hand, well, that could happen to anybody. I mean, that could happen any time. It's no big deal. But on the other hand, in that particular situation, that meant a lot to me. And I made a connection between my need for God's assistance and the cannery having too many beets. So at the time, it was an enormous salvation. But 2 or 3 weeks later, it's just one of those things that happens. It's very difficult to keep things in perspective and see God coming to my aid when he does. See God's activity when it's there. And in this particular situation, Pharaoh had come to a point of crisis. But as soon as the crisis is gone, it's no big deal anymore. The pressure's off. So the next plague, the third of the first trilogy. Verse 16, then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the earth, that it may become gnats through all the land of Egypt. And they did so. And Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the earth, and there were gnats on man and beast. All the dust of the earth became gnats through all the land of Egypt. And the magicians tried with all their secret arts to bring forth gnats, but they could not. So there were gnats on man and beast. So this is the first one that the magicians have not been able to replicate. Interestingly, the magicians replicating the other ones would only have made things worse. They wouldn't have made things better. The magicians were unable to turn the water back. The water of the Nile back from blood. And they were unable to deal with the frogs that were already on the land. Their trick was only to add more frogs. That's what they were capable of doing. Or turning the river redder, or whatever they did or could do. But this one they couldn't do. They tried to produce the gnats, and that's something they could not do. Verse 19, then the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Now, it could be that these gnats are coming out of the corpses of the dead frogs. That's the connection that is usually made. If these are natural phenomena, then what happened was the river was particularly red and had bacteria in it, killing the fish, fouling the water such that it could not be consumed, and such that the frogs could not stand to be in the water. So the frogs leave the water, go out on the land. There they die, and in their rotting corpses then, they develop some kind of insect that flies around. So it's possible then that we have some natural phenomenon that God has put, lined up in such a way that Moses could command and they would happen on time at his command. So whether they were natural or supernatural, we can talk about later when we've looked at all of the plagues. I'd like to look at all of them first. But in any case, it was clearly divinely superintended, whether they were natural or supernatural. And they were all designed to show Pharaoh that, first of all, his gods were not up to the task. Yahweh is the boss of the Egyptian gods. But they were not in the same league as Yahweh. And he demonstrates that first by showing that, by turning those things that the Egyptians considered to be gods against them, and secondly, by doing things that those gods, that his magicians can't replicate. So this is just the first trilogy of plagues. We will see two more trilogy of plagues, and then the final one of the Passover, the death of all the firstborn in the 10th plague. Questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. Just had a little wondering about the analogy of Pharaoh and his hard-heartedness, and that there's this process of things that are happening to him that are breaking him down, seem to be. Mm-hmm. And any sort of correlation to our process in our hearts and our own rebellion, in forms of it. I mean, that if we are to see ourselves, well, I guess I just wonder about my own process of coming to faith, or what that means and being realized to me. I mean, I do the same things you do, David, when mm-hmm. things are desperate. You know, I get very religious mm-hmm. about my need and about my inability to meet those needs, and I'm really open to God and all that. Mm-hmm. But I wonder about how this process of crises may also be truly instructive, and also in a way kind of the most instructive for us, mm-hmm. and that maybe we need them. Mm-hmm. We need plagues, mm-hmm. because otherwise we have the luxury to go through our lives not knowing that we have a tremendous need. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a long ways from Pharaoh.
That's an excellent question. It's something that I should give more thought to. I think that it is a difficult thing to be the most powerful person in the world and come to faith. When human beings are in a position where they have considerable power to wield, there's something that comes with that is the sense that a sense of arrogance that I am indeed powerful, that I can indeed control things as is necessary. And the more power one has, it seems to me, the more difficult it is for that person to realize their powerlessness. And the reluctance there is to recognize that powerlessness. I'm becoming more inclined as I get older to see, for instance, wealth as a kind of curse. Because if one is wealthy, it becomes increasingly difficult to see how needy they are. Because everything that they think they need, they can buy. And if they aren't satisfied, there's a tendency to think it's just because I didn't buy the right thing, that there's something else that I need to buy. And I suspect that power is the same kind of thing, that Pharaoh here has an enormous amount of power. In fact, at this time in the culture of Egypt, it would be considered a god himself. And that must really play a number with a person's head, to be treated as a god, to be for everyone around to treat you as a god. It must really, on the one hand, it must make him feel the center of the universe. On the other hand, there's a great responsibility that comes with that, a big burden that comes with that, that would probably also be overwhelming. But he's obviously reluctant to give up on that power. That power is important to him, and he doesn't want to yield any of that. And he doesn't want to let these people go. And I think part of that is a power trip, a power hungriness. He can't let this source of manpower leave his control. I know I didn't answer your question, but it's a good one. What is going on, and what is going on in Pharaoh's head? What is the dynamic between these challenges to his power and then his responses? And it in this account, it goes back and forth between two things: God hardening his heart, and I can't remember how it puts it the other way, but it either says God hardens his heart, his heart was hardened, or he grew stubborn. So it uses three different grammatical constructions to describe what's going on in the course of these plagues, which is very curious. And we see that elsewhere. They seem to be much the same. They're virtually synonymous. That both there's something that's from the perspective of God, it's something that God is doing, and from our perspective here in this world, it's something that he himself is doing. You got a question?
Yeah. Being a seven, is God just there in Moses? As a God, Pharaoh? Is he maybe trying to get through to Pharaoh about... But what does he mean by God there? You know, is it a kind of a play on the concept of God, or Pharaoh's concept of him being a God?
Mm-hmm. Possibly. I'm inclined to take it in a rather minimal fashion. And that is, in this relationship that I'm setting up, I'm going to send you, Moses, to Pharaoh. And I'm going to send Aaron with you. And you guys are going to play out certain roles. And those roles are, you, Moses, will be as a god to Pharaoh, with Aaron playing the role of prophet in between. So I think what he's doing is setting up a picture of a relationship that he builds on later, and that is the relationship between God, prophet, and man. That the relationship between God, prophet, and man is similar to what we have here, Moses, Aaron, and Pharaoh.
So...
the whole point that Moses is when God rule, as it were, it's not for the sake of even communicating anything to Pharaoh. It's just sort of
I don't think so. What he's done is he's put Moses in this role where, with respect to Pharaoh, with respect to Aaron, with respect to the people of Israel, he plays a God-like role. And when you think about that, that's very interesting, because he was prepared for that role by God giving him a speech defect. That Moses is perfectly... He has the perfect attributes to fit this role, and that is, one of which is what we would consider to be a defect. God wanted that defect to be there in order that Moses would not be the one who would speak to the people directly. Aaron would come in and fill that role, thus creating this picture that I think he wants to create.
But didn't God want Moses to speak, and it was only by Moses' insistence that he didn't speak, that Aaron was brought into the picture? So it was by the fault that we have this picture of God.
It was one of Moses' concerns. When he listed his concerns, he says, "But I can't talk." It was his third concern, "But I can't talk." And God's response is, "Well, I'll send Aaron, who's on the way." So, yes, it was brought up first by Moses, but I think it's clear it was preordained by God, even to the extent that Moses was already on his way to meet, Aaron was already on his way to meet Moses when that happened. Yes, Gordon?
Wouldn't this question kind of relate to his question? When he says, "Has God," wouldn't it be sort of challenge to Pharaoh's authority? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
To a certain degree.
Well, everything that Moses is sent to do, I think, is in essence a challenge to Pharaoh's authority. All of the plagues are calling into question Pharaoh's position as the all-powerful ruler and even divinity over, well, he's not all-powerful divinity, but all-powerful ruler and a divinity over Egypt. So there's a sense in which all of these acts are calling that into question, are a challenge to that.
How long has Egypt been around at this point as a civilization?
Well, I'm not sure. Dating the events here is a little bit tricky. But let's say it's 1400 BC. So Egypt has been around for about 1,000 years at this point. Okay. Thank you.